Welcome to this week's Casterbris Podcast with a K, available on Casterbris, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boom.
The Podcast with a K. Hey, it's Saturday night, so what better way to entertain ourselves than to record a podcast? I'm Christian Crawley. With me is erstwhile denizen of Pennsylvania, Brian Terranova. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
Hello. And pretty much bedded in Norfolkian. That wasn't meant to sound rude. James McLean.
Hello.
Hello. How are we? We haven't all been together for ages.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It has. And so we've had a few things going on with the podcast and different podcast combinations and things. Trying to keep it fresh for you, dear listener, on the podcast with the K. Hey, guys, I've got a bit of news for you, actually.
Yeah.
Go on.
I'm not going to the reasons why, because that's very domestic and boring, but I'm actually standing down from my role as a radio presenter in the next few weeks.
Really?
Why is that?
Yeah.
but you aren't. Reasons. Yeah. Oh, I hate domestics.
Yeah, so it's just timing and summer holidays and other things that we've talked about off air previously. So that's what's happening there. So, but I'd be surprised if any of our podcast listeners listen to my local radio ramblings, even though they are available online on Mixcloud.com. So just search Zetland FM if you are interested. So I'm stepping down from that. But I think I've gained a lot of useful experience from that. So, yes, that chapter is coming to a close. And speaking of chapters coming to a close, we are this evening on the podcast with a K. And it might be morning where you are, middle of the night, lunchtime, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's all relative. We're going to be talking about Ace, a Doctor Who companion who, it could be argued, had a nice rounded period on the show, or it could be contentiously argued that she had her story cut off midway. She has quite a strange story. I've always thought of her as the quintessential 80s companion. She must be far and away the most rounded 80s companion, but she doesn't come along until the last 2 years of the show. It's like the BBC didn't know what the 80s were until 1987.
It is true. She seemed a little... I remember at the time people feeling that she wasn't quite right. I mean, I was, 11, 12? And I remember feeling that she felt like a sanitised BBC version of the 80s. Yet, with a little extra distance between now and then, I don't know. I think there is something that's sort of fairly honest about her.
Yeah.
I think maybe the name was the mistake with her. I think the name was just too on the nose. It was too, youth. If they'd actually called her Dorothy and just had her as she was, I think people would have probably felt she was more believable. I think this fake name, and no one in the 80s really had a name like that. I didn't know anyone who would sort of call themselves a singular name. I think that probably distanced people from being able to connect to her.
Yeah, I think, we've had companions throughout the 80s. So, before Ace, obviously, we had Mel. Before Mel, we had Perry, Turlo, Tegan, Nyssa, Adric. Have I missed anyone, have I?
Don't think so.
Romana was there, but she wasn't created
there.
Yeah.
And of those, the only one who is a contemporary 80s character, well, there's two of them, obviously. Mel isn't. Is Mel? I'm not sure. No one really knows what Mel is, do they, really? So she's a programmer from Pease Pottage. That's about it. She knows all about megabyte modem, so God knows what period she comes from. You've got Perry, who isn't really contemporary British because she's, quote, American, and she does a bit of swimming. And you've only got Tegan, haven't you?
Mm.
Who isn't British, but obviously lives in Britain, or lives and works in Britain, or out of Britain, and has 80s hair. And that's really it. It's really superficial, the whole 1980s Doctor Who companion sort of character development. Once you scratch the surface, there really isn't an awful lot there. Until you get to Ace. And all of a sudden you've got this character who is, by the end of it, more realistic, arguably, than most, you know, soap characters. Perhaps on a par with something you'd find in a Mike Lee film, in many ways. Brian, as an American, when did you first encounter Ace?
Oh, wow. In the 90s, actually.
Was
probably 94, 95.
Okay. And was the sort of 80s British teenager sort of character type coming through for you? Or was it just like crazy girl with a stupid name?
I don't know much about the name, but I will say, like, the dress sense and so on, it struck a chord with what I had known of British 80s. Not fully, but I mean, like, that era, that kind of look. More so, like, a little bit, like, a hint of, like, the punk scene, and then a hint of, like, the 80s kind of regular. Like, I would say the first kind of dress sense in the show, in that era, rather, for a companion that struck me as 80s was actually Tegan in Resurrection of the Daleks.
Nice.
But no, I really liked Ace, and I think one of the things that kind of really made me start to feel the 80s nature of Ace was Remembrance of the Daleks with her boombox.
Yeah.
I mean, 80s, the 80s here were obviously similar but different, you know, similar because we had the same kind of music going on for the most part in movies, but our dress sense and your dress sense, you know, we're not always in sync with each other, so there's differences and so on. But I got a feel that she was from the 80s. Like you said, when you watch Mel, whom I believe from the books and even the radio dramas they say is from like 1987, mm-hmm. You don't know where the hell she's from, because when you're watching her in the show, you can't say she's timeless, but you also can't say she's from the 80s. You know, she just dresses very oddly.
She's barely there as a person, is she? She's pretty much just a puppet reciting lines. There is very, you know, scratch the surface on Mel, there's nothing there.
Well, you know, the one thing I've always said about her too is that, no disrespect to Bonnie, but, you know, she was very much used to theater acting, and that comes across. Because everything she does is like she's on stage having to project for an audience, rather than actually something like Ace, for instance, who actually did understand what acting was, a lot of emotion came out with Sophie, and a lot of good subtle moments, a lot of good deliveries came from her, you know. And so I really took to her more because I felt more for her, because she felt more real. Whether or not she felt like she was really from the 80s for me, I don't know, because like I said, they're different, but I did get a hint of 80s. Certainly knowing she was from the 80s, I guess, helped put that projection in my mind, and like I said, Remembrance really helped sell it for me after that.
These days she's in EastEnders from time to time. I don't know if she's still a permanent character, really? Or what Bonnie Langford is. She's much better on the sort of camera acting. I don't think she's done an awful lot of acting since Doctor Who and up to.
Well, you know, she's a lot better. Yeah, she's a lot better in the radio dramas too.
Yeah.
That's why I said, like, no disrespect to her, but you can tell when somebody's used to one thing, and we know that she did a lot of musical theater and a lot of I don't know if panto for sure, but we know that she did a lot of theater, just period musicals and so on. And that's what she's used to, and that's what she did. And if I'm right in this, wasn't TV new to her when she got the role in Doctor Who?
I'm not sure if it was new to her. I think TV acting was new to her.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, you know, she'd been on TV, but she'd been in dramas as a kid. Like, she was in a TV production as a child. Can't recall what it was. No, Just William, perhaps. McLean might know. James, though, I'm not going to ask you about that. I'm going to ask you about character development.
You are?
With regards to Ace.
My God, this is like... it's like being with a fortune teller who is informing me of my own future in an albeit slightly localised and slightly mundane way. So in the future, you're going to be asking me about character development.
Yeah, about now.
I don't think it's going to happen.
You don't?
Okay. I think it's fake. I think it's fake. I think Houdini would cast you as a fraud, mate, with your projections of fortunes and everything. See, it's not happened.
So anyway, what about Ace's character development over the course of her, you know, two and a bit series? Because there is something going on there which really doesn't... there's obviously attempts to do stuff, Nyssa aside, because, you know, what can you do with an alien orphan princess thing? But, you know, we've got Tegan's, so, like, urge to go home. We've got Tolo, who's quite an interesting story. But then with Ace, it's on a completely different level, isn't it?
It isn't initially, is it, to be fair? I mean, when you watch Dragonfire, you don't really get the feeling she's going to be anything massively different.
But there is that kernel of something there, isn't it? That sort of, like, strange story of how she ended up there.
Yeah, but is that particularly any more different than the Mel appearing from her future into her past, you know, to help him out on her, you know, it's this same sort of slightly bizarro, but it's not really character based. And it's only when I think they start working out that they wanted to be character based. Do we have like Curse of Fenric, as we spoke about a few weeks ago, where you have that end scene which tries to dovetail it retrospectively. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because something clearly was happening at the time that made them decide, and this would be lovely to try and get Andrew back on the show to talk about that, the show, to get him back on our meagre little podcast to talk about this, but quite why this shift happened. Because there's no indication of it there with Mel at all. That is very traditional. And then you get to Remembrance, and as you say, there is a total change in the balance. And I don't know whether it's because they decide to try and disassociate the Doctor more, so therefore they need to look at the companion, so it becomes an incidental byproduct of how they change the Doctor, or whether they're kind of looking and sort of saying, maybe there's something here, maybe writers are saying, can we do more with the companion? Maybe they can make the story. I don't know. It's a tough one. But yeah, there's certainly nothing ever before like it, and it's just interesting that he pretty much got the same team involved between, what's it, is it season 24 and 25?
Yeah.
I can't remember, is it 25, 26?
No, the last three series are 24, 25 and 26.
24, 25, yeah. So between 24 and 25, you've got pretty much the same crew on. But you have this sort of... But then saying that, I mean, there's stuff happening in 24, which is slightly more mature than perhaps what you'd seen before. Well, you've got hints of it with, say, Vengeance on Veros, but the... You know, things like the happiness, Delta and the Bannermen, you haven't really seen since Robert Holmes' sort of era of sort of playing around a little with commentaries on that are beyond science fiction. I don't know. Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I think it'd be interesting to know what they would say about it, because it's a very far more sort of contemporary, like maybe it could be just simply writers becoming more contemporary and more zoned in with science fiction and television, finding ways to... I wonder if there was some influences outside Doctor Who which made them think about... I can't think of really any science fiction at the time, really, outside Doctor Who that was particularly going in UK or stateside.
2000 AD is about it, I would have thought.
And that really isn't a particularly good example of
Doctor Who... I think it must be a comics influence thing, though. I think there must be an influence of comics.
I don't know. I mean, is it? It could be... It's very hard to say. I mean, you've got what the authors you've got on season 25. I mean, you've got Ben Aronovich. You've got Mark Platt. Is Mark Platt in season 2? No, he's season 26, isn't he? Who else is in season 25?
Well, let's look it up.
I'm trying to think. Who did Survival? Not Survival. See, my brain's going. What? Greatest Show in the Galaxy, isn't it? Silver Nemesis.
Yeah, so Greatest Show in the Galaxy, Stephen Wyatt. Silver Nemesis is Kevin Clark. Happiness Patrol, Graham Curry. As you say, Remembrance is Ben Aronovich.
So you've got a whole new wave of new writers, but I would still suspect that the key there will have been Cartmell and, well, pretty much Cartmell, I'd have thought.
Well, season 24 with Paradise Towers, that's also Stephen Wyatt.
And again, well, I mean, it's a very traditional format. Paradise Towers again, isn't it? I mean, there is a bit of character stuff, there's stuff for Mel to do, and you've got this sort of slightly interesting thing with Pex as well, which is almost companionish, but really it's still by the book.
Well, Ian Briggs, who wrote Dragonfire, did Curse of Fenric. So there's a bit of bridging between. He's kept a few writers on, and so like they've obviously developed considerably between the stories.
But is it just the writer development, or is it
I think there's a maturity in the attitude of the production, isn't there, as well?
So there's got to be something which is beyond the writers, I think, which informs the show. Because as you say, Dragonfire and Curse of Fenric are leagues apart. And it is interesting, as you point that out, given that it's Ian Briggs, presumably, who comes back with this retcon on Dorothy.
Yeah.
On Aces. Because I'm sure that was not planned in Dragonfire. And it's obviously hinted at through, I imagine, sheer coincidence with the Silver Nemesis chessboard as well. I don't know. The chessboard in Silver Nemesis is interesting. Do you think that is just a sort of a bit of serendipity that they cottoned on to, or do you think they did have a long-term plan? I can't imagine they did.
I think they've said since that there was a plan, haven't they? So, but I mean, often plans are. Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, and often, well, George Lucas has contradicted himself many, many times. Often plans are just there at the back of your head, aren't they? And then they turn out to be little more than happy accidents, serendipitous, as you say. Even when they actually come to fruition. So it's very difficult. With something like that... I mean,
with Ace, I always kind of wondered whether the idea was the original pitch, and again, I'd like to know, was more that they wanted this 80s character who was stuck in the future, and then you could have this sort of fun of having this contemporary girl, sort of feisty girl in this futuristic setting. And so the time... I mean, again, was she wasn't actually initially... Can you remind me? She wasn't initially going to actually become a companion, was she? I thought that was again, it was that whole Bonnie Langford thing of her deciding last minute again that she was. So they had to do that hasty rewrite for the outro for Mel.
Right, I'm not sure.
Yes, that's right. I think I remember that. Yeah, because it was Ace who was meant to go back with Glitz,
right.
And then there was a shift, there was a change for whatever reason. I think it was Bonnie Langford, and so because I remember them saying that last scene was pretty much written on the fly, speech about time, and they got one rehearsal shot at it and then they went through. So if that was the case, it might explain why Ace had such a sort of vague backstory, that she was the time blow, you know, explosion in her chemistry and coming to the future, because there was no actual real thought of her having any particular future, possibly. I'm sure if anyone's listening to this, they can probably correct us if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that was the case. I'm pretty sure there wasn't that much. Interesting. Brian, you're very quiet.
I'm listening. I'm the listener today. Oh. I was following the logic, but I don't have the background for Ace like that, like you were, so I could not interject.
Yeah. Well, again, if we'd done our research before doing this, we'd perhaps have something solid to...
Where's the fun in that?
Well, where is the fun in that, indeed? And for a dear listener, basically, what we kind of decided at the last minute to get together this evening when we all realised that we're all quite boring people with no social life. And so we were... And then we had a bit of a question over whether James was going to make it or not with some technical issues. So we were actually... Brian and I were basically going to stretch a podcast over the... The comparatively short behind the scenes Star Wars Rogue One video that was released this week.
Oh, I've not watched that.
Well, I haven't watched it yet either. I would have watched it in the podcast.
Okay, I see.
So how that would have gone, God only knows. Gordon only knows. Gordon's alive.
I still thought we were just going to talk about our lunches, so shows how aware I am today, you know.
Well, what did you Star have for lunch? What did regular. You have
No, forget it now. You no, don't want to talk about Ace and Star Wars. You don't care about my lunch.
You've brought forget it up that. Again. I want to know now.
Do you want to know? You want to know what I had for lunch? Fine.
Well, hang on. I'm going to guess you're Italian. It was lasagna.
No, I'm also lactose intolerant Italian. I can't do that. What kind
dry
of a sick joke is that? Dry, yeah. Oh, God. I have had tofu raviolis before, where it's a strange thing where they make tofu... tastes like ricotta cheese. I don't know how they do it, but it was actually pretty darn good.
Right now, my finger is hovering around that hang up button. So if I'm doing that, I'm guessing people listening to this might be on that same sort of tread towards
this tofu ravioli.
Here's a question. Here's a question for the...
Yes.
I was going to say the three of you, which is mildly disturbing, but...
I think you should.
The three of you, whoever the other one is.
You.
Oh, yeah, I suppose it is.
You're speaking in the third person now, James.
Are you talking to me or James? I've got three. I can think of three alternate... It's two or three alternate explanations for where Ace finished off. Do you have a preference?
I like, because purely because of what happened afterwards and the emotional investment that I had with the series, I prefer the comic book version.
Right.
I think there's something slightly disturbing about the novel cover. Was it First Frontier? Of Ace in the One Piece.
Right.
You know, from an aesthetic point of view, it's quite nice. But really, narrative-wise, I don't really like where they took Ace, but I do... So in the New Adventures, I'm talking now, Brian. So, yeah, sure. I prefer the comic book. I'm not entirely sure what happens in the audios, though.
Well, I don't know. Have they actually got to the end of her story in the audios?
No, they don't end her story, but it's kind of weird. The audios are kind of a weird place because they used to do adaptations of the New Adventure books. And when they did that, they used to... every audio has a story code. And once upon a time, when Gary Russell was in charge there, the story codes, when he was a producer there, I should say, the story codes meant something. So, for instance, if it was like a 4A, a Tom Baker story 4A, production code 4A, they would make their story, if they wanted it between 4A and 4B, they would make their story be 4AB. This way it took place in between 4A and B. And then they would do, if they wanted to keep a whole series there, it'd be 4AB, 4AC, 4A, you know, so on and so forth. But when they did adaptations of the New Adventure books, the story code was it was SS for sidesteps, indicating that these particular audios were sort of an alternate reality version of these adventures. And so therefore, there was the big Finnish continuity and there were the book continuities. And you could interject them within the TV show continuity however you wanted. After a while... sometime, I believe, before Nick Briggs, but certainly after Nick Briggs came in, the production codes meant nothing anymore, it seemed. They didn't really seem to care where they were slotting the stories. They just cared about telling the stories. But also when it came to telling book adaptations and so on, they kind of like blur the line a little bit more, that they now start to state that Ace's TV time. And then there's a handful of adventures in the radio dramas where Ace's stories fit into her TV time. But then you also have stories when, if I'm not mistaken in this, when Philip Olivier, who the heck does he play? Hex. When Hex comes into the story, Ace has already left the doctor and come back to the doctor. If I'm not mistaken, that's that. But for sure, they tell Bernice Summerfield stories where Ace has already left and has come back to him. So she's left. She was a Dalek hunter. She did all sorts of things, and she came back, and now she's traveling with Bernice and the Doctor. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. You don't really get a true end. And they certainly, for somebody like Mel, for somebody like Ace, they don't try to give you either their intro or exit story, respectively, you know, and it's something that's always bugged me a little bit, to be honest. So I don't really, I have an idea of Ace's kind of alternate realities. I know one of them, she dies, and I know one of them, she just becomes a Dalek hunter. I would really have liked to have seen where the show would have gone, unless, of course, that's the Lung Barrow story, in which case I really don't want to see where the show would have gone.
Well, where does Russell take her? She's one of the people that Sarah Jane talks about, isn't she?
Yeah, a charitable... I can't remember what the last part of Ace is. A charitable something, isn't it? So she becomes some sort of...
See, that doesn't even sit well with me. I can picture Ace coming back to Earth. I can also picture... We met Ace in space. She was already used to not being on Earth. So I can easily picture her staying out there and feeling like she found a place to belong in a place that she could be some sort of either military leader or just a leader of a people in some way, or a defender like the Doctor. I can see those kind of things. I can even see her, if any companion was going to come back to Earth and work for UNIT, I could see Ace being one of them. But I don't know. It seems like all of the exits that she's had, from the books to the comics to what Russell tried to state in the Sarah Jane Adventures, they just don't sit right to me for the character.
No, yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I can see why he would reject the new Adventures version of Ace. I can see that, 'cause it's a bit Torchwood, but yeah, I don't like what he did. But I mean, but
do you remember how she ended up in the books? And I think I'm trying to think what book it is now, which actually deals with her finale, essentially, because Sophie Aldred does a foreword for it.
Oh God, which one is that? Is that the wedding one?
No, it's a Kate Orman one, as I recall. Right. It's one of the later ones, where basically she has a place in Paris, I think, in the past.
Oh.
She has a time traveling bike.
Well, not Human Nature. It's after Human Nature. The one with Doctor Who.
Yes.
Head Games.
Yeah, she's in Head Games.
Head Games. Yes. I think she's left, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I have great difficulty with them giving companions time travel technology. Like, we see Captain Jack has it, and on one hand, I'm kind of okay with that because he is a time agent, which means that there is a an organization for that, where you were taught the ins and outs of time travel and what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
But somebody like Ace and Clara, given their own time travel methods, who are just humans, who have a history of just jumping in head first rather than thinking about the situation, and often questioning the Doctor when he brings up reasons why, as a time traveler and a Time Lord, you can't or can do certain things. It seems like just giving these companions time travel technology is just inviting them to go out and screw up the universe. You know, I don't really like those ends. I think they should do something more human with these humans. They should be better than when we found them, because they should learn something and become something more of themselves. But becoming the Doctor is to that degree in any way shouldn't be. I just don't think any companion should have that. You know, I can't picture any of them getting their own TARDIS, getting their own time travel bike or what have you, and it making sense. Except, well, obviously, Romana. That would be the only one.
But she actually, interestingly enough, as you pointed out, she becomes the first one to do that.
Yeah, exactly, she does.
She is the template that comes from the New Adventures, which, as you say, Clara...
I'm sorry, who is the first one?
Ace.
Well, no, Romana technically is.
Romana doesn't
have anything, does she, at the time?
She just sods off with K-9.
Who says that he has all the specs to design a TARDIS for them? So she's going to go get a TARDIS in that universe.
I don't think so. I don't recall.
Well, no, that is what happens. But you know, it's implied that that is what's going to happen. But she's a Time Lord anyway. She's not human, so.
Well, exactly. Well, that's okay. So Ace is the first human. Yes. Okay.
Well, I'd say Ace is definitively the first.
You could say it's Ian and Barbara, couldn't you?
Oh,
well,
God.
Well, not really, because they're just like using a taxi cab back to Earth.
Yeah, it's still a time machine.
Because with Romana...
But they did the right thing with it.
Well, exactly. The mechanics of the AC is different, isn't it? Because it's actually a creature, if I remember rightly.
Yes, it
really
is.
Some sort of time-sensitive creature that delivers her through time in a set period. She can't go further into the past than the 19th century. She can't go far into the future. So
it's somebody who already probably has a handle on what they should or shouldn't be doing throughout time.
Presumably, yeah.
Okay. James, you were trying to say something, though, about Romana?
Because I remember with Romana, one thing that always struck me is that it was always, the narrative always suggested that she was in E-space. After that, there was always, we left her in E-space, or she is in E-space, or...
Yeah.
I mean, I always imagined, personally, that she would, as actually the narrative eventually suggested, was that she'd go back to Gallifrey. But to be actually honest, at the time and through the 80s, I always imagined she never did. I always got the impression that she would stay and help those people, even though she might have potential to go elsewhere. I got the impression was that she one of the things was that she didn't want to go back to Gallifrey, that she had sort of learnt from being a free agent like the Doctor, and she wanted to stay and help the people there. And
That's exactly what I thought too. I always thought eSpace would have just become her home where she had her freedom, because clearly she didn't want to go back to Gallifrey. She didn't want that lifestyle. She began to feel like the Doctor and see what freedom was really like. And I kind of had this feeling that if she ever kind of came back into our reality, well, then she would be back on their radar again and go back to Gallifrey against her own will. That said, over the years, I used to wonder what it was like for her. Was she in eSpace, or did she come back into our reality? Is she out in our universe fighting evil the way the Doctor does? And I was cool with the idea of that, or eSpace, either way. But when Big Finish, and I don't know if this was a book thing first or not, but when Big Finish brought her in as the president of Gallifrey, it felt so wrong. You know, it felt like it could have been right for Romana 1. But for Lala Ward, for Romana 2, it seemed wrong. You know, she had this distaste for Gallifrey and this, she didn't want to be there. It didn't make sense. She didn't have the same air of authority or royalty about her as Romana 1 did, as Mary Tam did. And it just always didn't sit well. It was kind of cool that she was there, but it also seemed like the Time Lords are always a foil to the Doctor, and they had to use her that way in the stories. They had to make her kind of put the Doctor in his corner and make him listen to their way and so on, and kind of be the issue from time to time. And it seemed wrong to do for her character. She should have been with the Doctor or helping him in some way. And of course, in some ways she did, but she would have to be that foil and hindrance as well, just by nature of being a president of Gallifrey.
There is, of course, another ending phrase that we haven't mentioned, and that's death comes to time.
Oh, wow, yes.
Yeah. So she has, we're looking now at four endings, I think, aren't we? We're looking at the Big Finish. No, still not Big Finish, New Adventures. We're looking at, as you said, the comics, Christian. You've got the comment by Russell T. Davis in Sarah Jane Adventures, and obviously we've got this as well, Death Comes to Time, which some people still try and fit in as canon, which I find is a bit hard, but...
It is a bit hard, but I don't remember her outcome in that story,
or
her place in that story.
I mean, I remember she goes to Gallifrey, as was going to be the idea, I think, for season 27, wasn't it, that she might go to Gallifrey to become a Time Lord, or that was the Doctor's idea. I can't remember specifically how she fits into the story, apart from the ending of the story, which I won't spoil for people who have not listened to it.
I had the pleasure of listening to Death Comes to Time since 2019.
No one has. No one has. People have listened to it, but people haven't had the pleasure of listening. it's not that bad, to be honest.
When it was on, that's the only time I've listened to it, so...
It had some interesting ideas, I thought, but I do remember thinking that they went places, like they went too far with it. I think they just they didn't try to keep it within the realm of the show or even where they were headed.
No,
as far as I was concerned, I did like the character Antimony. I liked what they were doing with him and the Doctor. I thought that was an interesting thing, interesting idea for a companion anyway. But yeah, as thinking of it as canon and trying to fit it into the actual continuing storyline for the Seventh Doctor, just it didn't fit. I had great difficulty trying to place it and make it actually make sense for me.
It was a bit of an oddball, because while it was meant to be, in some ways, it was suggested like it was meant to be the final story. And yet at the same time, if memory serves, and memory might not, they were kind of hoping to do a series of those sort of BBC audio at the time, and it didn't do very well, so they didn't do any more, but they did sort of finish it, you know, with the first story almost. It was one of those mistakes, that sort of thing that John Nathan Turner always said that he feared with The Ultimate Foe, was to sort of have the Doctor and Valiard float heading off into time, intertwined forever, would be too much of a finale that the show would never come back from. And maybe Death Comes to Time did that by mistake and made it feel like it had come to an end before they'd even tried to see whether anyone wanted any more of a series.
Great cast, though, because, you know, you've got Antimony, which is Kevin Eldon. You've got John Culshaw in there with a few people. You got Jacqueline Pierce, Blake Seven. Leonard Fenton. Wasn't he in EastEnders?
Not sure. You're missing the big one, obviously.
Hang on. Leonard Fenton, wasn't he Dr. Legg? Yeah, Dr. Legg in EastEnders. Stephen Fry, John Sessions, and Anthony Head. And Nick Courtney.
I mean, it's worth listening to any aficionado of Doctor Who just likes it and just likes to experience, because it is an interesting and unusual take, which we've never seen done before.
Well, what's interesting is that this sort of, it fits nicely in that kind of little sort of guerrilla operation of Doctor Who fans at the BBC in the late 90s, early 2000s, isn't it? It's like, you know, secretly putting out some Doctor Who under the radar, as it was. You know, I mean, it got some publicity, but, you know, they were doing it on the radio, they were doing it online, well away from the gaze of BBC One.
Yeah, so again, while it wasn't a proper ending for Ace, it sort of had put her into a different direction than all the other paths took her, which I think is... I mean, I was very much a book fan, so I sort of ended up... I must admit, I agree with Christian, and I agree with you as well, Brian. I didn't like the time-travelling aspect of her ending. I didn't like that at the time. I didn't like this idea that she becomes her own sort of mini-doctor who does various... Now, she's not a bounty hunter, but she's not for hire, but she does sort of... She's an agent, almost. She's a time agent, as far as I recall. She would pop around and try and stop certain things, and... I don't like that. I agree with you. I think, again, I've said this before in podcasts, it's the Batman and Robin scenario. You know, people are fine with Batman flying through, swinging through the city, but as soon as you have Robin next to him, they both start to look a bit absurd. And I think the more people who become time agents, the more it sort of diminishes the Doctor's role.
Yes.
The Doctor's role. So, yeah, I agree. I think that's probably one of the reasons I didn't like it. And one of the reasons I didn't like the Clara doing the same thing, or even to some degree, when Captain Jack was first introduced, I was a bit, I can buy it, but do we really need to go there where everyone is just sort of puddling through time doing their own thing?
I think we probably better just
I will
outline.
Say one thing that I don't know if this is part of her time traveling aspect or not, but one thing that I do like and I think is a tad fitting for her is her basically becoming a Dalek expert.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of can see that either she got accidentally left behind or purposefully left behind in an era where there's a Dalek war, and her just being the demolitions expert that she is and being as clever as she is in that sort of respect. I can see her having joined a fight against them, not in a doctor capacity, not in a time traveler capacity, but certainly as an expert on them, or certainly as a good military personnel and even a leader, I'm sure. I could see those things, and I think that would be an interesting direction for her, someone who just wants to continue stopping evil. Because I will say one thing I really do like is the way that Big Finish uses her in the Hex era. When they introduce Hex, he's kind of the novice character. He is the one who doesn't understand, you know, what you do. He's a nurse, but he doesn't, you know, time travel was weird for him at first. Fighting evil, he's out of his element because he has to first learn, like, that this is something that we're actually doing rather than just time traveling kind of thing. And Ace, instead, is the expert with the Doctor. And rather than, even though you still get this because it's the Seventh Doctor and it's never going to go away, but rather than being left out of the Seventh Doctor's plans and actually being used as a tool or a chess piece in his plans, Ace is more so with him and aware and kind of a sidekick or a lieutenant or something like that with him, you know, second in command in some way. And she's interesting because she's more seasoned rather than like when they do like obviously plays that are set during the TV show era where they try and make her be this 80s kid again. She's more seasoned. She's more grown up. She's seen some bad things, and she's a little bit reluctant to come close to people. And instead, she just kind of adapted to a lifestyle with the Doctor where you travel, you face danger, you live your life in danger 24/7, and that is your life. And I liked that because I kind of felt I could see that with Ace, that, you know, when we first find her, she's on an alien planet fending for herself, and she's very gruff with people. And I can see that be a coping mechanism at first, but then when the more that you hang out with a guy who all he does is travel and fight evil, that's probably what you're going to pick up as the thing that you're good at doing too. And that aspect kind of fit with me, not for an end, but kind of a direction for the future version of her character. I liked where they took her with that.
I like it on this idea that if you see her being, as I think the books try to suggest, as sort of like the soldier, he was making her into a soldier in his war.
Yeah.
That she becomes a soldier, but he doesn't predict that she actually becomes a soldier in someone else's war, that he takes her down a path and she eventually rejects him, but embraces the soldier that he felt she could be, and goes off to fight Daleks and leaves him to puddle around again for a little bit before they reunite later on. I agree with you. I think the soldier aspect is certainly slightly more her than the Ace Charity.
Yeah.
I just didn't like, as you say, quite how they just didn't really know how to finish her. I think that's probably an interesting thing with Ace is that maybe, if we're all very honest, and this goes back to Christian's preference, Ace is a character which ultimately would only end when she actually is killed in action. If she has got that much anger that she doesn't reconcile, that you can't really imagine a soft, gentle exit for that character where she lives happily ever after.
We should probably talk about that a little bit, because a lot of people probably won't know about it.
Well, I mean, that's another
fair... I'll detail, so we can just quickly summarise it.
Okay.
So basically, this happened in 1996, at a time when Doctor Who magazine was gearing up for having the Eighth Doctor. And they'd also just recently decided that the comic strip had been running since 1979, so it had been running for like 17 years, so it was strong enough to stand on its own 2 feet, rather than, as had previously been happening, intertwining with the new adventures. So basically what happens is there's a storyline which is kicked off here and continues way into the Eighth Doctor's era, with a new enemy called the Threshold. We have the appearance of Ace, Susan, Sarah Jane, and Perry in this story as well. As you say, she gets killed in action.
I mean, is that just us, though? Is it because the extended media place some more out that warrior aspect on her, because let's be fair, in season 26 she's still not that different. She's more, the more emphasis is actually that she's less of the soldier and more of a woman, is the it's a direction she's going in, and then the books and the comics and the audio plays sort of focus a little more on the more aggressive element, which is obviously more interesting for the stories.
Again, in the comics, she's not, you know, she's not the super Dalek soldier that you get novels. Yeah.
Well, even in Big Finish, they tone that down, even though they do sort of, as Brian says, is that half suggestion that did sort of happen, but maybe not to the extent. It's a hard one to balance out. I suppose, in a sense, I think I'd have preferred it to have gone down the growing up rather than becoming the soldier. In the same way, I think in the new series, there is too much of that feeling that these hitchhikers become very accustomed to the world to the point where they almost become a doctor themselves, which can lead them to either being problematic like Clara or just cool, apparently, like Rose.
You know, it's interesting. I was going to bring up a point that, we're neglecting which doctor she's with, which was the Seventh Doctor, and how, yes, this happened a little bit later in his era, but he became the doctor that plotted and planned basically everything that he did. And so perhaps he's a doctor that didn't just randomly pick up companions the way we've seen in the past. Perhaps picking up Ace was kind of always on the cards for him, or maybe when he picked up Ace is when he saw this direction for himself even. And perhaps prepping her for her future of being that soldier was something that he was trying to do. But then when you brought up the fact that the season 26 made Ace kind of realize more so that she could be a woman rather than this soldier, rather than a child from the 80s or a soldier, I guess we should say, it started making me think, like, did we kind of get the series one story in season 26, season 25 and 26, because in series one, we have the doctor who needs Rose to remind him that he is a person, he has feelings, and he can be happy and okay again. Whereas in Doctor Who with the Seventh Doctor and Ace in season 25, she's that very gruff kind of kid. She's very abrupt with people. She doesn't really want the emotional attachments. She is just wanting to blow things up, kind of destroy the world almost in a way. But you're right. In season 26, she starts to kind of calm down and see that, you know, hey, people aren't so bad. And maybe that's what she was seeing through the doctor. And maybe that direction is the best direction they could have gone for her. But it's interesting to see that we kind of had that storyline just reversed with Doctor and Companion before series one did it, because I never thought of it before until you said it, but it's definitely there.
Mm. Mm. Is that a shame though, that we've never really seen a companion particularly grow up? They just grow into, either they don't grow or they become fantastical, or they become, like we've said, attuned to the Doctor rather than people who could probably live themselves. I mean, I suppose Amy and Rory are possibly the only two examples.
Sarah Jane?
She never really changed, though. In fact, she sort of diminished until she returned. I mean, if you think of her, how hard-hitting she was as a reporter in the first few stories, and while as a personality she obviously was more charming and more better connected with the Doctor by the end of it, there was a natural resonance there. Personality-wise, she hadn't really grown, had she? There was no indication that she was a different person, a more mature or confident person than she was when she met in the Time Warrior. We don't see that sort of progression, that the experience makes them grow as a better, rounded person. They just come out the other end either with a love interest or, you know, as I say, Tegan's possibly the only one who doesn't. Tegan's perhaps the only one who does grow, but in the wrong direction, where she realizes that she hates what she's been going through. She doesn't want to do it anymore.
You know, I was going to say, too, that Jamie, for sure, was a companion that grew, but then they take it all away from him.
Yes, that's true.
Which is a sad thing, you know, that he definitely grew the most. And, well, at least I feel he grew the most, because he had a lot to learn. You know, he was from a time where basically no technology. He had to learn even just technology, not just how to treat people correctly or treat women correctly or anything like that. But I really feel he grew a hell of a lot. And now you're right. It's a shame. Like, do we have a story where a companion just left being a better, I mean, there's Martha, you could argue, left just kind of realizing things about herself to be a better person. I mean, yeah, they kind of made her go work for UNIT and then go freelance, still kind of doing doctory things. But originally her exit was just because she realized, hey, you know what? I'm a doctor and I don't need someone by my side, essentially, to make me feel better about myself. I'm going to go be me and go do good in this world. So I suppose
I
you could say she did
that,
the same.
To be honest with you, it doesn't. What's that? It doesn't sit right with me, the whole Martha thing.
No.
No, well, I don't feel it's particularly convincing.
Well, why she left, or when she returned, or when she returned in End of Time.
The End of Time thing. It's
Oh, that, yes.
She's not convincing. She's okay in Torchwood, but, you know, generally and overall, the thing with Mickey seems trite and obvious. I've never really been a big fan of that.
Yeah. You know, and we've also got, too, when you think about it. I agree. What I was talking about with Martha, though, was her Series 3 exit. I agree that, you know, later on when she was working for UNIT and then working for, well, Torchwood, of course, and then going freelance, those are the things that kind of turned her back into exactly what we were saying. But her original exit did actually show her just being somebody that was improved through traveling with the Doctor.
I suppose I can think of a couple, actually. Two are inferred, and one is actually quite specific. You have, I mean, obviously Ian and Barbara, it's inferred more retrospectively in the books and the media that they grew. Certainly in the original books, they say, I think in the Crusaders, they say that Ian's become bronzed and well-built through his constant adventures. You don't see that in the show, but you could argue that even though we don't see it, that those stories have brought them together closer and more confident in themselves, but they never seemed underconfident in the first place. So they're one, possibly. Your second one I was thinking of, and they've gone out of my head, my second one, but, oh, Harry. Harry's sort of, again, it's inferred that by the end of it, he will certainly have learnt a lot. He doesn't go because he's found love. He doesn't go because he's become a super person. He goes because it's time for him to go back. He wants to be back on Earth and do his thing. So he's sort of done experience, and now he'll probably apply it. So again, it's inferred. The only one that I think is actually specified is Turlough. Turlough is a very shifty, and he's obviously avoiding his to some degree, he's avoiding his legacy, which he has to confront and deal with in a positive way in Planet of Fire. So you could almost argue Turlough is affected in a strong way, in a positive way. But even in Planet of Fire, there's still that tension about him being a coward, and so I recall anyway, and the Doctor not trusting him because he won't.
Yeah, and I've got another one where they definitely changed the character for the better and then immediately took it away, and that was Donna. She had a lot of growing up to do, and they did a lot for her to make her have confidence in herself and actually just become a better person, and then they immediately took it away, and she became that shallow person we first met. And I get what they were trying to do there, but it's a shame because they finally actually did achieve exactly that and once again lost it.
Yeah,
that's a shame. That seems to be something that they really, you would think that they would do. Like, all these people talk about that their lives have been enhanced through the Doctor, but all we see is that most of them have become in some way soldiers like him, well, through him, rather than people who actually go make a difference in the world in a better way. Not to belittle what they do.
I think the sad thing is a lot of these characters, in the end, their personal development is really just a reflection on the audience's connection to the Doctor, in the sense that, say, with Martha and Rose, certainly, you have two people, and Donna, you have people who, it's their involvement with the Doctor causes dissonance with their families. So you're not really seeing them grow, you're seeing them struggle between this fantastical life and their normal life. So there can be no growth because they're sort of polarized between trying to balance the two. And it's funny that really, going back to Ace, Ace is the only one really where you have this example of someone who is just, who is a little lost originally, well, totally lost geographically, and starts to have to reconcile her past and naturally become a woman. I think that's the whole point, isn't it, by series 26, is it's not that she is, it's not just her confrontations with things like her mother and the house that she burned down, it's her sort of coming to terms with her sexuality, with that, as we said, that really awkward scene in Curse of Fenric. But these are sort of attempts to try and show that she is growing up naturally without the Doctor's involvement or anything. It's just she is growing up. And you just don't have that. And I think that is a shame, really. Just, you could do that with a new series quite well. You could take someone like Rose, or you could take someone like Amy, and you could have had her slowly grow up. But you never could, because she was always meant to be on par with the Doctor. She was always meant to be able to put him down and put him in his place. And as soon as you do that, you don't have that child level to build on, to give her the strength to become a person. She's already there at the first point because she's got to impress the audience with how sassy and clever she is. And so you lose that opportunity. And I have a suspicion that Bill will go the same way if that clip we saw was anything to go by.
I don't know. Did we talk about that before? I don't remember, but that clip with Bill bothered me just because although they were talking about a Dalek and not the TARDIS, it was just ripped from Donna's dialogue, like her first moments with Tennant talking about the TARDIS. It was just like, it was like almost word for word from that scene. It was so strange.
I didn't notice that, really.
Yeah, well, it was the, you know, when she's like, what is this? He's like, it's a TARDIS. A what? A TARDIS. A what? A TARDIS. Oh, you're just saying words, you know, and then they had the same thing. What's that? A Dalek? A what? A Dalek? A what? A Dalek? You know, it was the same. And I was just sitting there like, oh, wow, we've already done this before. Like, we're going here again? Just didn't feel right with me. I'm not like, you know, I'm going to give her a proper chance, but I remember when I saw that scene playing, I was sitting there going, okay, is this actually a scene from an episode, or was this, because like usually when they do this, hey, this companion's been announced or the Doctor's been announced, they did a little special for it where they brought the actors out specially to talk to you, and I thought maybe this is just a scene that they recorded specifically to say, hey, check out the new companion in action. But I'm afraid it's going to be actually a scene within the show where, you know, Moff just basically ripped off Russell, and it's just weird.
It's interesting.
Now you say that, I can see why you would say that.
Yeah.
But you couldn't actually see why he would have said that before he actually said it.
No, I
right.
No.
Which is odd, because earlier on you were really good at that. You said that talking about the character's development, and in fact I was actually. So I think you're slipping a bit.
I think I probably am. Well, it's getting late, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Wait, it is. For
it is for us, yeah. So, Brian,
That's me.
James?
Yeah?
Have you been watching anything interesting lately?
No.
Doing anything our listeners might be interested in? Or our listener might be interested in?
Hello. Well, what I'm always very cautious about talking about things I am watching or listening to that I know are slightly old, that other people may have watched and listened to, and then may spoil it for me. But I'll take a gamble, since the majority of the people who I am at the moment interacting with passively can't actually tell me directly through geographical locations, space within this Skype group, and of course the fact that, well, they're not here. They'll be listening to it later on, is Falling Skies, which I knew nothing about until a colleague of mine was sort of mentioned it in reference to a rant about Independence Day 2 or whatever it is, where we were both sort of saying, surely they could have seen early on that there was no point of doing a second Independence Day film. And he mentioned Falling Skies, so I found it on Netflix, and I've just been chewing my way through that and really enjoying it. So that is what I've been watching of late.
Okay.
But, Independence Day, the recent one, is a fascinating misstep on the grounds that the reason that the original Independence Day worked was not for any sort of nationalism, and it was not for the fact that aliens were new. What it worked on was these very iconic images of places exploding, you know, big, major. Now, we've had, since at least 2008, virtually every summer blockbuster film, maybe actually earlier, 2004, has been watching cities being destroyed. So you kind of think, what did you really think you were going to bring to the table here if that is your gambit, if that gambit is your gimmick, when everyone has been doing it, every summer blockbuster? That just seemed to be crazy that no one saw that was going to be a problem. But no one did.
Yeah, Falling Sky. I can see your point. So this is a Netflix series, yeah?
No, it's a US series. I'm sure Brian's aware of it.
It's not on Netflix.
It is at the moment. It was
but it's not Netflix.
It came out
produced,
2011, yeah. And it's four seasons of it on Netflix at the moment, and the fifth is waiting to be popped on at some point.
I have no idea what it is, actually.
No, you don't. Okay, well, I better explain to you and all the viewers who do know, listeners who do know what it is, and it's just you two ignoramuses who are going to...
Ignoramai, I think you find.
Which actually I think might be one of the aliens from the show.
Right.
Okay, cool.
They sound a bit like that anyway. Yeah, the idea basically is it is essentially if you take V and you put it with, I don't know, Independence Day or maybe Battlestar Galactica, is essentially it's a story of aliens have invaded the Earth, but you don't actually get to see that. It starts off after they've won. And it's about the sort of American resistance is trying to actually survive, basically, for five seasons. So you have that sort of very sort of mixture of action and soft character drama, like you'd sort of get in V, but done with a little more skill and consistency. It is a really good show. It really is. So if you've not seen it, it's really worth watching. The cast is very interesting, too, because there's not many big names in it. Noah, what's his name, from ER, is the lead, which is quite an unusual lead. But it has a sort of slight feeling of an 80s show, too. So it feels a little out of place. But yeah, it's very good. It's got that sort of lovely sort of ongoing narrative that you get with war stories where people do die. So you're never quite sure who is going to live, who's going to die, which continues on in that sort of serial nature. It's really, really enjoyable. Well, for me anyway, some people might find it very boring because it is a sort of, you do get very long character scenes sometimes. It's not all loads of action, but it works really well for me. So yeah, if you've not seen it, it's only 10 episodes per season. It's on UK Netflix. First four seasons are anyway. And I believe the fifth season is the conclusion. So you've got hopefully a full story to enjoy, not sort of dead end as you get with some shows, especially from those shows across the continent, Brian. Continent, the water bit. Sea.
Yes.
So sometimes that's a horrible thing. You see a show on Netflix, think, oh, I might try that. And part of you is thinking, yeah, but did it get cancelled?
You know, that's been my life with any TV show I've been trying to watch, you know, for years. As a matter of fact, a lot of shows that I really enjoyed got canceled and were left on big cliffhangers. And, you know, one that I always go into, which I thought was a fantastic show, not even sci-fi, but I thought it was a fantastic show, got canceled because of the 2009 writer's strike. Basically, the show ended on a cliffhanger. It had its like second season. It was a pretty massive cliffhanger. And then the writer's strike happened, and it was just years later that was resolved for this TV show for whatever reason. And they were just like, well, we're not going to renew that. And it was The Riches with Eddie Izzard.
Oh, yeah. I saw the first episode of that.
That was a really good show. The premise was interesting, and the way that they handled all the characters living in that situation. I mean, I shouldn't really talk it up too much because I'm going to get people to watch it, and then they're going to get to season two, and they're going to be like, F you, Brian, the show has no ending. I know. That sucks. It doesn't have an ending. But no, I mean, the premise was just basically they were gypsies, wanderers, nomads or whatever. And, you know, they were just, you know, their lifestyle was just conning people, pickpocketing people and so on. And they kind of accidentally take over the life of a lawyer and his family because it's just a husband and wife. They didn't really, the two people didn't have children, but they died in a car accident that the Eddie Izzard and his family had witnessed. And they kind of were just like, hey, it's a place to stay for the night. So they thought they would stay in their house for the night, you know, even though they just witnessed this like tragic thing, they thought maybe we can just stay there. And then they kind of got wrapped up in living their lives. And it was interesting because they were all, instead of like traveling, instead of living in their car in the van or stealing houses per night here, there and everywhere, they all got wrapped up in having this family life, this house and this lifestyle. And it started to like fall in on them, the more lies that they would do. But it was a really well done TV show. And, you know, as a lot of shows that I like that get canceled are. And then, of course, it never came back. And it's a sad thing to see. So, yeah, it can be a tough thing when you start a TV show on Netflix that is still currently running because you never know what's going to happen to it. Matter of fact, a lot of times when I do see a TV show that I see nowadays and I want to check it out, I will actually, like, if I know it's already done, I will Google if the show had an ending, because yeah, it bugs me when I watch a TV show that is left dangling. I can't stand that.
It's like Musketeers, and Musketeers is on its last series now, and luckily they knew about it, and so it gets an ending. So,
Well, that and what's that other show? Survivors. I really liked that show with Freema.
Did it actually get?
What's that?
Did it get an ending? I never watched the end.
No, well, you know what?
Series, wasn't there? And
yeah,
yes. But it's weird. It did get canceled. But I'll tell you what. It's and you know, I would love to hear opinions of any listeners on this. But I was bummed. It got canceled, so it did not have that third season that they were going to go for, and maybe even get an end. Who knows? But kind of the way the second season ended, I felt like it was the end. I felt like there was going to be retribution for why this outbreak had happened, and these characters kind of were all in places where they, you know, they could continue on where they were, and we didn't need a TV show after that. It was, you'd have to see the end to see what I mean. But when I watched it, I was kind of like, when I found out there wasn't another series, I sat there and I went, you know what, as far as TV shows that ended abruptly or got canceled, you know, this one, I can actually see how this ending does work. Yeah. As an ending, even though that was not intended. And so I was a little appreciative of that, because I was still able to enjoy that show, because I thought that was a really well done TV show.
It wasn't bad. Max Beasley was good in it.
Yes, yes, he was.
I just looked up Max Beasley on Wikipedia. His full name is Maxton Gig Beasley Jr.
Nice.
His father Gig? Was Maxton Beasley Sr., a professional jazz drummer. So there you go. And he's also, James, he's also appeared in two episodes of Last of the Summer Wine in the 80s.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
As a teenager.
Oh, that's awful.
The thing about Survivors as well is that it's a good show. I enjoy Survivors. I'm not sure if we've got it on DVD or not, but it had a good cast.
Yes.
Patterson Joseph was in there, who was in Bad Wolf, and often touted as the doctor that was cast, who then turned it down. We'll never know who it was. And also Julie Graham. Who has Julie Graham done any Doctor Who? I think she's done audio, hasn't she? But I don't think she's done TV. But she was in a show at around the same time called Bone Kickers. Do you remember that, James?
name's familiar.
It had the chap out of the pirate, Curse of the Black Spot, who was in Downton Abbey, that Hugh Bonneville. He was in it as well. Yeah. And it was basically a sort of Indiana Jones sort of thing on a weekly basis, but filmed in the UK and squeezed into sort of 50 minutes. And it wasn't very good. In fact, it was so not good that I used the term bone kickers as a kind of substitute for shit. So I just, you know, something was crap. You know, I was working in an office with colleagues at this time. I would say, oh, it's just a load of old bone kickers. You know, it wasn't a good try. It only got the one series. It wasn't too good, unfortunately. But no, the Survivors remake's quite good, I think. I've only seen a couple of the originals. Have you guys seen any of the originals?
Yeah. No, I tried. You can't get it over here. Or at least you couldn't when I looked.
Right, okay. I know it, back in the 90s, it was in bargain bins on VHS format in low-cost supermarkets and department stores. James, what were you going to say?
Yeah, no, I saw the first three or four episodes. I would like to follow a bit more because there was a few changes as the show went on, which is, and again, sits on a similar sort of premise as Falling Skies, you know, post-apocalyptic human race trying to survive, whittled down to those same sort of numbers. So, yeah, no, I think it's. I watched the first episode of the new Survivors, and I'd say compared, I far prefer the Terry Nation version. The Terry Nation version is really strong. If you get to see, if nothing else, if you get to see the first episode, it really beats the US version hands down. The US version, the more recent version hands down.
Yeah. Okay.
I like shows from that era too, so that was another reason why I was looking for it. I, you know, obviously we talked about before. I like watching The Saint, The Persuaders. I even tried watching. It was an American series, The Invaders, and I just like TV and films of those times. So I really wanted to see the original Survivors, but I just can't get it here. It's same thing. The same thing with Blake Seven. I can't get that here.
Blake Seven's tough.
And I've been curious
here
about that.
It's tough
is it
to get here? Yeah, unless you're fortunate enough to run into, you know, a flea market secondhand store that's selling the DVD or VHS box set. It's going to be very difficult to get hold of it, which is a shame.
Yes.
Okay. Well, in terms of myself, I haven't really been watching anything, but I'll tell you what I've got here, which I'm very excited about. I'm going to start reading it this weekend. Just withdraw this tome from my Waterstones bag. I have got the graphic novel of The Star Wars, based on the original rough draft screenplay by one George Lucas.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Have you read it?
I looked over his original treatment stuff, and not obviously at the time. I mean, funny, sort of small 1 to 2 year old. Sort of saying, no, this is terrible, mate.
Yeah.
No, it's I've always been a great believer that Star Wars really only existed through that second sweep in editing, which made it come together. But the original ideas were just, oh dear.
Well, I'm intrigued by this. I'm not expecting anything like what we eventually get. I'm kind of. I'm looking at it really from just to see what was going on in that early stage, and maybe sort of embrace the developments in my own work, I suppose, which is obviously constantly ongoing. So yeah, I'm looking forward to reading that over the next few days. School holidays, great, yeah. So. Guys,
yeah,
I think that brings us to the end. Pregnant pause. Yeah, I think that brings us to the end of this week's podcast with a K. So, dear listener, thanks for joining us, and listen out. Stay tuned. Subscribe to all the audio. Well, subscribe to probably Audio Boom. That's probably the best place to subscribe to. or iTunes otherwise. And putting an Audio Boom ahead of iTunes, Corley, what are you playing at? Well, basically, our iTunes feed is fed by Audio Boom, so that's why. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.